Awesome. Good afternoon. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, June 6th, 2019, will now come to order. We have a quorum, both physically and telephonically. The vice chairman is with us by phone. The first item on the agenda is correction and approval of the minutes. Commissioner Hunter, would you do the honors?
Sure, thank you. I move approval of the minutes, agenda document number 19-22A.
Thank you. Commissioner Hunter has moved approval of the minutes for the meeting of April 25th, 2019, as set forth in agenda document number 19-22-A. Any discussion on the motion? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 And the motion passes unanimously. The next item on the agenda is draft advisory opinion 2019-07. We have some late submitted documents. Commissioner Hunter.
I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the commission may consider agenda documents numbers 1923A and 1923B.
Thank you. Commissioner Hunter has moved that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider the two drafts for advisory opinion 2019-07, agenda documents 19-23-A and B. Any discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 And the motion carries unanimously. Mr. Wensinger.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good afternoon, commissioners. Agenda documents 1923A and 1923B are draft responses to advisory opinion requests submitted by Area 1 Security, Inc. The requester asks whether it may offer free or low-cost cybersecurity services to federal candidates and political committees. The drafts conclude that the proposal is impermissible because the provision of such services would result in in-kind contributions. We received no comments on the request, one comment on the draft, and a supplement to the request this afternoon. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Wensinger. Mr. Patalis, would you like to come up to the microphone? Because I have a feeling we're going to have some questions. And I understand you have your client with you. Mr. Falkowitz, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions or comments on the advisory opinion request or the drafts? Commissioner Hunter?
Yes. Good morning. Welcome back, Mr. Patalis. It's very nice to see you.
Good to see you, Commissioner.
I thought we would maybe start off by asking Mr. Patalis to explain your proposal sort of from the beginning. Your original submission did so, but I think your subsequent comments provided a little bit more clarity, and there was a little bit of a question about some of the representations. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of giving us an overview, I think that'd be very helpful and maybe a good way to start.
Happy to. Thank you, Commissioner. So as you know, we've submitted a request. The request specifically seeks the commission's concurrence that the proposed pricing model that Area 1 Security intends to use in connection with providing specifically anti-phishing services to federal candidates and political committees would not, in fact, amount to an in-kind contribution under the existing framework and rules in place in campaign finance. So sitting at my right is Oren Falkowitz. He's the CEO and co-founder of Area 1 Security. Previously, he worked at the NSA as well as the United States Cyber Command. He attained the highest level of security clearance at NSA and worked on cutting-edge computer network issues, and was part of the hacking team. After that work, he transitioned to the private sector, where he co-founded Area 1 for the purpose of creating and transforming the way cybersecurity is provided, and specifically with respect to anti-phishing issues, which, as this commission is well aware, is of particular concern with respect to certain federal candidates and political committees, which are a highly targeted and, frankly, underprepared potential set of clients. So Mr. Falkowitz is with us today, and he can answer, I think, in great detail questions about the pricing strategy and the service offering. And so I'll leave that to him so that I don't mess it up. But as to the sort of the legal outline of the request, it's our view that we're not here asking for the commission to do anything different than what the law already provides. A yes draft should not require an exception to any rule or overturning any prior commission precedent. It's our view that what their pricing model is premised on, the business considerations that they use, fall well within the ordinary and normal course or the kinds of activities that the commission has in the past blessed as not constituting an in-kind contribution. As the commission is aware, the legal issue is this pricing strategy fall within the normal and ordinary course of their business, and are they proposing to offer it to federal candidates and political committees on the same terms and conditions that they would offer to non-political entities or individuals? And the answer to that is resoundingly yes. And so we can talk about why that is so. The commission has, within the last year, addressed similar requests. The Microsoft AO, of course, 2018-11, is the one that comes to mind. And it seems to us that opinion really ought to be conclusive here. The rationale for saying yes there, if anything, you know, to a tech titan that has substantial ongoing issues before the same political candidates that it is seeking to provide its free software package to, nonetheless got an advisory opinion saying they could do that for good reason. And specifically, the same set of factors that apply there apply to our request, I think, even in stronger measure. There's only one, the first factor that was considered in the request relating to Microsoft's provision of services to existing customers that was weighed in the decision to say yes to Microsoft. We're not looking to provide services to existing customers, it's true. But to be frank, it's not, if you look at the request that Microsoft sent in, it doesn't appear that they had existing, that all of the people they were giving free services to that were political entities were also existing customers. You know, I think the request said that often election-sensitive entities and organizations use their products. But they didn't say that they were only giving this free suite of software to existing clients. And the rationale in the Microsoft opinion that sort of turned on the question of existing customers actually related to Microsoft's assertion that they wanted to protect their brand from damage if an existing customer was hacked. That was how that was used in the opinion. But here, you know, Area 1 does one thing. Area 1 provides anti-phishing services. Right, and that's the particular thing that federal election or federal candidates and political committees are particularly vulnerable to, and particularly a fruitful target. This is sort of the ground zero of this sort of foreign national battle in cyberspace. So, for Area 1 to not be able to allow its employees to work on those issues damages Area 1's brand as well. And it damages, you know, if you think about our rationales here that were, there were really, there's a four-factor test as to, you know, which relates to the wherewithal of the entity that seeks the services, the longevity of the anticipated provision of services, and then, of course, the research and development benefits that come from providing those services, and also what we've sort of summed up as the pride factor, but which is actually, you know, more complicated than that, but essentially goes to the economic benefit that flows to the entity by having its, that comes from allowing it to recruit, retain, and motivate some of the most sought after, highest valued tech engineers in the business in a very hotly competitive marketplace. For them to be excluded from this particular contest would be, you know, this is the fight that they're prepared, that they are prepared to make, and it seems completely uncanny for them to not be able to do it because of a regulatory regime that honestly isn't, I think, the issue before the FEC doesn't really relate to what it is Ariel 1 wants to do. This isn't a sort of secretive way to make a contribution in order to influence an election, which is really the bottom line question. This is the business that they're in. It just so happens that the entities and individuals that are being most hotly targeted falls within this sphere of, you know, political candidates, as we saw in 2016. So it seems strange to exclude them from that. And in every other respect, the Microsoft opinion is right on target. You know, the same issues, the same concerns that the commission stated there apply with more or greater force with respect to our request. So on the legal side, it's our view that this falls squarely within what's the established framework for these kinds of activities. The commission shouldn't have to extend the law or to say yes, shouldn't have to overrule any past decision. It's consistent with the law, and so that's why we're looking for a yes here. I know Mr. Falkowitz had sort of comments ready. I don't know if you want to just do a question and answer or
we're happy to hear Mr. Falkowitz's comments. Thank you. I suspect they will be illuminating.
I'm sorry?
I suspect they will be illuminating.
I can only hope. Good afternoon. thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm proud to be representing my company. The mission of Area 1 is to eliminate phishing. And a phishing attack seeks to make a computer user, an individual just like you and me, take an action which causes harm. And I want to give a few examples. This could be the downloading of a file that's attached to an email. This was the case in November of 2016 when the Russian GRU sent phishing emails to over 120 email accounts used by Florida County officials administering the 2016 election. Another example could be trying to get an individual, just like you and me, to click on a link. And this was the case in 2016 when John Podesta, the chair of the Clinton campaign, was directed to a website where he thought he was changing his password, but in fact was turning it over to Russian cyber actors. I co-founded Area 1 after serving for nearly a decade at the National Security Agency, and I've made it my mission to stop these phishing attacks. Phishing is how foreign cyber actors launch their offensive cyber campaigns. It's how criminal organizations around the world conduct their business, and it's about how 95% of cybersecurity damages occur. Repeatedly and almost exclusively, the report on the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election refers to phishing as the cause of damage inflicted upon the U.S. electoral process. Now, it might sound simple, these phishing attacks, but the reality is that as humans, we can't be taught to be less human, right? We have an innate curiosity, a willingness to trust complete strangers, a childlike interest in a good story, and all of these work against us in cyberspace.
You're calling childlike there, Mr. Falkowitz.
I was referring to myself, man.
Okay.
All of these work against us in cyberspace, and that's what makes it impossible for humans to be independently trained or made aware of how to stop phishing attacks. And as such, the software that my company develops is sought by organizations around the world. Area 1 Security has developed the most imaginative, comprehensive, and proven solution for eliminating phishing attacks today. And we're proud to be protecting many of the largest companies in the world, many of the fastest growing startups in categories like advanced computing, new space, as well as many nonprofits and humanitarian organizations. We've developed a business strategy that is rooted in accountability and accessibility. Many organizations who desire to protect themselves from phishing often have very limited financial resources. They often have limited professional cybersecurity staff, and some of them only operate for short periods of time. And as such, our strategy considers the needs of these organizations. Because we get research and development opportunities often, and the revenue growth that comes from better research and development, and the pride that we earn in protecting them from phishing. In a recent letter to shareholders, CEO of JPMorgan Chase, J.B. Nyman, suggested they will spend up to $600 million protecting the bank from similar cyber attacks that federal candidates receive. We can't expect each campaign organization to pay as much for protection against the same types of nation-state attacks as large corporations who face similar, or even in many cases, less sophisticated cyber campaigns than we're seeing in these elections. Candidates seeking federal office have sought our solution. They've expressed to me personally specific fears about being phished. They've also shared concerns about the cost of cybersecurity solutions. And I'm hopeful that your advisory opinion will provide clarity that the pricing strategy that we provide to everyone on an equal basis is something that they can take advantage of. The most successful businesses in our economy today are data-driven. That means that they must both recruit and retain exceptionally talented computer scientists, as well as experts in big data, advanced mathematics, computer vision, artificial intelligence, linguistics, as well as subject matter expertise in their domains. They must also have access to data, and data-driven companies can't live in a vacuum as the algorithms we develop are dependent on more and better and continuous data. And so for us to be commercially successful in cybersecurity, there's a need for access to real attack scenarios, and these scenarios are particularly acute as they relate to elections. The cybersecurity data decays at a rate 58.3 million times that of uranium-235. And so relying on historical or forensics data, it's totally insufficient to progress. Our strategy, it's not based on altruism or patriotism. It's just simply good business for us. And it's also within the mainstream of how modern software as a service business operate. Being in front of these foreign government cyber attacks, which are uniquely prevalent in U.S. elections, is an extremely important opportunity for Area 1. I just want to be clear that we're not offering services to candidates to curry any favor. Frankly, I'm not sure what that favor would be, because unlike other corporations today who offer free solutions to federal candidates, Area 1 performs no lobbying, we make no political contributions, and further, when our software is used properly, it's unnoticed by 99% of the employees who work in an organization. There's no application. You don't log into our product. It runs silently in the background. Today, our software is used by hundreds of companies, and it analyzes billions of email messages, stops tens of millions of phishing attacks, and it remains only known to a handful of IT or specialized cybersecurity staff within those organizations. I'm here because we want to stop phishing attacks and support our business goals. That's our mission and specific purpose, and I thank you for allowing me to help answer any questions you might have.
To thank both of you. That was a very well done overview by both of you, and congratulations on the success of your business. That's exciting.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Madam Chair. Yes. First of all, Mr. Patelis, I apologize that I can't be there in person, but I really appreciate you and Mr. Folkowitz being making yourselves available to answer some questions. The question that I have is just, I need some clarity as to how you plan to apply the four-factor pricing model. I believe that Draft B is premised on the notion that as a class, that you would plan to exempt political committees, federal candidates from having to pay for these services. However, subsequent information indicates that might not be actually correct. Could you confirm how you're going to apply this model? Is it the case that you will be applying the four-factor model not to political committees and federal candidates as a class, but to each individual committees, which may result in particular clients receiving services at low or no cost?
Mr. Patelis.
Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner Peter, or Vice Chairman Peterson. I really appreciate you're making yourself available to call in so that we could have our quorum and do this today. So it was very kind of you. Yeah, it's the latter. And Mr. Falkowitz can address this as well. But the proposal is not to carve out special pricing for politically related entities and candidates. Not at all. The proposal is to apply our ordinary four-factor test that the entity applies whenever it's a fixed fee for services. In other words, when it's not the pay-per-fish model that the company also offers. In those instances, they look at the same four factors, and that's what they'll be looking at here for these clients as well. The issue is that from our experience, and I'll let Mr. Falkowitz jump on this because it's actually his experience, so I don't mean to co-opt him. It's our experience that political actors do not have the expendable funds for this sort of activity or this sort of vendor service to pay the same amount as a large commercial entity does. And at the same time, there's fewer operators, there's fewer systems that need to be reviewed, and the research and development value skyrockets in this area because this is the hotbed of this kind of hacking attack. So when you apply the four factors to these sorts of potential clients, it comes out that what comes out the other end is generally a lower price or no price in some instances. I'll turn it over to Mr. Falkowitz.
Yes, well, we don't treat any potential customer organization differently. Our commercial teams primarily work with companies that have 5,000 people employed there and using their computer systems or larger. And so when nonprofits or humanitarian organizations or startups or candidates come to us, they typically fall well outside of our traditional pricing scheme. And so because there are significant opportunities in those examples, I'll give an example. We've been working with a company in the new space arena that's been heavily targeted by Chinese cyber actors, and there are 30, 40 people. They had a need to use our products, and so we created a tier of pricing that was flat for organizations below, you know, that 5,000 threshold, so to speak. And so we intend to do the same for political candidates.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, if you had, let's do two extreme examples. On the one hand, you have a long-serving senator who has been in for multiple decades, has a huge war chest, and is likely and is thought to be almost a shoo-in to be a reelected. The way in which you apply that four-factor pricing model may be different in that case than a long-shot candidate who's running as an independent, has a shoestring budget, and has virtually no chance of winning. Is that a correct understanding?
We don't consider the forecasting of what happens in the ballots. The way we observe organizations is by their size. And so an elected official that maybe has 100 staff members is just a 100-person organization to our business. It's no different or greater depending on how much is in their war chest, so to speak. In enterprises, market caps and revenues are not good indicators for budgets for companies, and nor are they in the amount of political fundraising that these types of organizations have. People want to use their revenues for intended purposes other than cybersecurity, and as such, you know, we choose to be accessible on that front.
So let me follow up on that question. What I hear you saying is that you would offer, your proposal is to offer these services for free to all political committees, regardless of their financial resources.
No, not for free. We have a tier of pricing which we would apply, and that price is $1,337. 1337 is a hacker term for elite.
I know. I get the joke. Very clever.
Thank you.
That's cute.
It's de minimis.
Yes, it is de minimis. So that's a question for clarification also. So are you proposing to offer it for free or for 1337?
Well, we would run it through sort of our test. I guess I would say yes for 1337. I guess there are scenarios where there could be an individual that's running who has very limited financial resources, and if it was a serious enough opportunity, we might call it zero. We call it little to no cost because the difference between 1337 and zero, frankly, is insignificant to our business.
Okay, so the proposal is, I want to make sure I'm getting the details right. The proposal is to offer these services to political committees for $13.37 a year.
And regardless, correct. All organizations, including political committees, regardless of
their the size of their war chest, they could, I mean, a presidential campaign might have $1 billion in their war chest. One candidate has stated that is his goal, to raise $1 billion. So even if there's $1 billion war chest, they're going to get a $13.37 a year rate. All political committees would get the same rate. Am I understanding that right or not?
Yes, you're understanding that correctly. Okay. Because the primary factor for us is size, not market caps, not war chests. that's not relevant to our processing costs and value that we receive from.
And the size that you look, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm just trying to.
It's the number of employees that would be receiving email or interacting with phishing attacks. In 2016, as an example, the Clinton campaign had a maximum of 4,000 people working for it, which is still below our typical commercial engagement. And, you know, the Trump campaign was about a fifth of that size. So they're still not the size of typical companies we engage with. So, yes.
Although potentially there could be volunteers who are also working on the campaign who would also be getting and receiving emails.
Volunteers, you know, anyone who has a candidate domain would be included in our count.
Okay.
Correct. If they cross that threshold, then we would reconsider.
So, and when you look at it, based on what's on your website, it looks like 5,000 employees is sort of the marker that you use.
That's how we typically train our sales team.
Okay. So I had understood from your written request that you were proposing to offer this service for free.
No.
But no, it's the $13.37 flat rate, right?
That is correct, yeah. Okay. What we call little to no cost.
Little to no cost. So the fact, and that...
My board members think that's free, right?
And, well, I agree, that is a great deal. $13.37 for what you're offering, $13.37 a year, that is a great deal. So when I look at the four factors, how do the four factors relate to the 1337 rate? Because it sounds like the client's financial resources, which is the first factor, doesn't really apply.
Well, yes. So typically, right, in an abstract pricing scenario, you would equate that a 100,000-person enterprise company has certain financial resources on a per capita head to dedicate to IT services. So that's an important element. So we make a proxy for employees and financial resources as they are related. Is that clear?
Okay. So that's your... So the first fact, the client's financial resources, really means how many employees do they have? It's not what their budget is, it's how many employees they have.
Correct. Yeah, they're related.
And the
let me give another example. Let's say like a hedge fund, for instance, has 100 people working for it, but has hundreds of billions of dollars in assets. As a company, we can't look at that company and price gouge them, right? We are providing services for a certain number of people. Even though they have large financial resources, it's inappropriate for us to go to them and say, well, you have to pay more just because you manage more money. Our services are only for the small number of people that work at that business.
And the second factor that you list in your four factors is potential longevity of the relationship. But that doesn't really apply here either, because you have no idea whether you're going to have a long-term relationship. If you are going to have a long-term relationship, it's not going to actually be a profitable one in dollars and cents because you're offering it at $13.37 a year.
I would suggest that applies greatly here. We expect our commercial customers to be engaged with us for 10 years or more. And most particularly presidential candidates, their campaigns and committees will not exist for that duration of time. And so, you know, we don't have those long term. So when we engage with a startup, you know, they might be working at de minimis cost to us initially, but they might grow to become a multi-billion dollar company. And so we take that as an advantage and would grow with them. It's very unlikely that these candidates will have the same types of growth as our commercial startup businesses would.
I that makes sense to me, but doesn't that argue for the opposite conclusion? Because if you're going to have a long-term relationship with someone, then one, I would think, would make business sense to offer them a deal at the beginning so that you get in the door and you have a long-term relationship with them. If you're not expecting to have a long-term relationship, then what's the incentive for offering them a deal on the rate?
The incentive, as we outline, is that in some cases, there are specific research and development opportunities. Some organizations are launching initiatives that will only be experienced for short periods of time. And as such, we can afford to take the costs on that because we're getting greater outcomes in the advancement of our products and services.
That's the one that makes the most sense to me. I can totally see why the R&D potential would make sense. I'm a little bit less clear on, I think it was Mr. Patalis who said earlier that you thought this would enhance your brand, I don't see how, you were talking about the Microsoft opinion, and in Microsoft, they were concerned that if people got hacked while they were using Microsoft products, that would make them look bad. If somebody gets hacked, none of these people are your existing customers. So if somebody gets hacked and they're not using your product, that can't affect your brand, right? What's the brand issue?
It was I who ventured into that, but I was actually trying to equate the pride factor in some sense is similar to the explanation the commission offered in approving the Microsoft AO on the brand damage point. So I wasn't saying that Area 1's brand is in jeopardy right now when they're not servicing these clients. What I'm saying is their employee morale is in jeopardy when they're not servicing these clients. And as the leading the leading technological solution to this particular problem in this particular niche, for them to be pushed out of the ability to address it would be harmful to Area 1. And that's why we're here.
As an example, when I worked at the National Security Agency, one of the draws is not compensation. It's that you get to work on the most important mission and solve the hardest problems in mathematics and computer science. It's the same draw that people have to our company. So if we suddenly remove from the Department of Defense's ability to do that mission, nobody would be there. And that's true for cybersecurity companies. If there was no opportunity to do the work and actually protect the people most at risk, people would find other opportunities.
I get that, but I find that factor to be the most problematic for me for reasons that I think Mr. Patalis can probably guess. If we're going to say that a company can offer free services or discounted services to campaigns because it will improve morale for their employees, what am I going to do when the next company comes in the door and says, hey, you know, our employees are really worked up about this election, and we think it would really improve morale if we gave everybody one free day off a week. We'll pay them to work on the campaign of their choice. Boy, that would do wonders for our morale. That would really, because, you know, stepping back for a minute, what you're proposing sounds like a great idea. The reason that you're here is because there's a law that says corporations aren't allowed to give freebies or things that are offered at a lower rate than they give to other clients to political committees because it's a corporate campaign contribution, and that's against the law. Now, Congress could create an exception in the law. Congress could say cybersecurity doesn't count. If you're offering cybersecurity services, you're exempt from the corporate contribution ban. They could do that. I'm not sure we could do that. I'm not sure we have the statutory authority to go that far. And the big picture question is, can we say yes to you without going that far and without opening the door to every other corporation in America who might say it's going to improve morale of our employees to do all sorts of nice things for candidates that our employees feel really strongly about, or to notch it up a bit, you know, for, I know I could imagine CEOs coming in and saying, my employees would really love to support my favorite candidate, so I'm going to give them all a lot of time off at the company expense to work for the success of my favorite candidate. Forget about their favorite candidate. They all want to support my favorite candidate. But in any event, this just seems to me, this pride factor, and happy Pride Month, everybody, different kind of pride, this factor strikes me as potentially opening up a colossal loophole. So tell me how that's not the case, or how that could be, how if we said yes to you under those circumstances, it wouldn't open up that loophole.
So It is a four-factor test. This is just one. Just start there. But that being said, I think there's a couple different buckets here. The commission has in the past sort of said, no, it's not a legitimate business justification to get to do something for goodwill, for civic duty or pride, for promotional reasons. It's not what we're talking about here. The question, I think, to be in the other bucket is how closely is this justification tied to the particular services that are being offered? And I think here, which I think would not open a loophole and would have to be apply if someone else was going to make the same argument, is that the particular services involved are mirror image to what it is Area 1 was designed to do. The problem that it was designed to do, nothing to do with elections, everything to do with anti-phishing services, right? The staff that we are talking about invigorating by being able to work on this problem does specifically this and really nothing but. This is the organizational purpose of Area 1, and it aligns perfectly with the services that Area 1 is talking about offering. So that's...
But any company could make the same argument. You know, a car company could come in and say, it would give our, all we do is make cars. We're really proud of our cars. We think they're the best cars. And if a campaign, a national campaign, were to use our cars as the official vehicle of the campaign, that would make all of our employees so proud they would want to work for our car company and not another car company. I don't think it gets you there to say, you know, this is the nature of your business, because there are all sorts of products and services that campaigns would want to use and could benefit from that are the sole and exclusive business of all sorts of corporations.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I understand that, but I think here it's a little bit different because you have a multi-factored test, right? And it's a sliding scale. And one element of it is this is the specific purpose of the entity that, you know, it's not an entity that is a trillion-dollar company that like others that might, you know, want to make similar arguments. It's a small company, and it doesn't have anything to do with influencing an election, which is really the bottom line question, right? It's a different story if somebody says, I'm going to give you the day off to campaign, you know, or I'm going to give you the day off to campaign to volunteer for my favorite candidate. I mean, I think that's an easy one, right? This is an entirely different element. This is the idea that we will lose employees, or our employees will not have the motivation to work the long hours, to create the, you know, patentable products. All the other sort of measurable elements of morale building within a company that does this specific service.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. So I'm a little confused about why we're, I know it's in the request, but why we're talking about the pride aspect of it, because I think you said that you're gonna charge certain size of political committees, if they're small, the 1337, both for political committees and non-political committees.
Correct. That's what we do today.
Okay, so you're thinking about making it lower if the pride element is high? Is that what you're saying?
No.
No, okay.
We intend to apply the same pricing to everyone as we do today. We have many companies that take advantage of that rate. Through my personal interactions with some campaigns, they have said they have had some reticence about that as whether or not that would be an intent to, we'll take the extra step and come before you to provide clarity. And so we're hoping...
Go ahead.
We're hoping that your approval here will provide that clarity that just extends our normal business practices today. We're not discounting anything, nor provide any particular elections pricing. This is what we provide to everyone of this size.
Then I actually don't even think you need to be here. I mean, if you're just...
Well, you need to talk to the candidates themselves, because okay. They will not adopt... these technologies without that clarity, that is why we are here.
Okay, so if we're able to say that you provide the same kind of service to political committees and non-political committees, and you're going to charge, you may charge them the 1337. I don't know where the pride is coming in. Again, I know it's in your request, but it seems to me that that may not even have to be a factor that we need to get into because of the subjective nature of it. It makes some people nervous, and I understand why. I happen to agree with what you said. This is part of what you do, and so it has nothing to do with trying to influence an election. This is where you get to show that you're the best in the business. If you're a dermatologist, you might want to provide your services for free to someone who's got a really bad form of something to show that you're able to handle that. So it's the same concept. I understand it doesn't cause me any concern, but to the extent that it does others, I'm not sure that we really even need to look at the pride element.
Well, let me respond to that. Okay. I actually thought that we had a path out.
Okay.
based on looking at your website today, and points to my summer intern, Hunter Calloway, for finding this and pointing it out to me. But your request talked about the four factors, and your request doesn't seem to line up with what it says on your website and what I think I'm hearing you say today. So if the request was, we offer 1337 flat rate pricing to all nonprofit organizations, regardless of, you know, we do it for political committees, we're willing to do it for political committees if they'll take it. We do it for other nonprofit organizations. You might think about state and local governments. They could also use your help, and that's not a question that you'd have to come to us for. But it's a uniform, you know, we've got basically our for-profit pricing and our nonprofit pricing. This would fall into the nonprofit bucket, and it would be our usual and normal charge for all nonprofit customers. That would be a lot easier question than the way it was framed in your written request. And, you know, in your most recent comment, you know, we reached out to you today after we found this on the website, and you got back to us and said, the discussion of pricing on that page is not comprehensive. The pricing determination for each particular customer is handled according to the four factors identified in our written submissions to the commission in connection with our request. So I think there could be a path forward here, but I'm not sure that it's the answer to the request that you gave us. And I'll throw out another possibility, because we told, you know, DDC and their AO that they could accept from, you know, C corporations cash and in-kind assistance. You could probably work with them if you wanted to do it that way under the auspices of that advisory opinion.
Well, we're certainly willing to work with anyone, but candidates are coming to us. And they're asking specifically because of the specific challenge that they face as it relates to phishing. Look, startups suck at pricing. What we're trying to do is give you the broad framework for how we treat everyone. So when we think about the world, we think about large companies, like the largest banks in the world and pharmaceuticals. But we apply all those four criteria continuously. Sometimes there are great opportunities to test a new feature, to test a new product, and we may make different decisions. The key thing is we do it consistently. And what I have found in folks in the area of influence that you oversee is that they're looking for clarity. And without that clarity, we're stuck. And that's why we wanted to take the step to outline what it is exactly we do in the broadest terms possible, so that clarity could be provided to them. We do it the same for everyone. We have many organizations that are using all of these pricing strategies today, and we want candidates to feel confident that they won't be referred or have some action taken against them to move forward.
You have a question, Mr. Wall?
Thanks. Nice to see you here today. The question I had was, because it's going to be fairly elementary, but first of all, why are you attracted to the legal profession, into the the political realm? What is it about that would engender extra pride than some other candidate, some other
Yeah.
Well, the customer or something like that. What? And then is this something that you provide 24 hours a day all the time? Is it during elections? Is it what happens when there's an advancement in your technology? How do you then apply that? Do you charge more to, for example, if something is more sophisticated, you want the, say, the regular level of sophistication and the very high level of sophistication depending on the potential attack? How are you looking at those factors?
No, sir. A fish is a fish is a fish, and there are no distinguishing factors of them. If it will cause harm and it seeks to get an individual like you or I to interact with it, clicking a link or downloading a file, as I identified, that's a phishing attack, and that's what we aim to stop. There are no grades of bad to it, and it's a mistake that people make to try to weight them in some ways.
But isn't it more difficult to get rid of a fish or prevent a fish with certain types of approaches, technological approaches, than others, or is yours uniform? I recognize that might be a real layman's question.
Oh, it's a great question. There are some advanced algorithms that we develop that are more computationally intensive or that challenge the imagination of our engineers in different ways. But at the end of the day, stopping one particular attack is just stopping one attack. And we treat it no differently in our pricing scheme. As Dan mentioned, our pricing often includes what we call pay-per-fish, where our customers will pay us $10 per fish. We don't distinguish, you know, this one's bad, this one's not good. As I mentioned, companies in today's economy are often based on using data to drive advancements in the world. And federal candidates in particular are acutely attacked by nation-state actors in the ways that commercial entities aren't or may not be for some time. So it's a real opportunity. Not that we're attracted to it, but it's a real opportunity to get in front of new attack types that are novel that might have benefit for our commercial clients at some later time. Mm-hmm. We can't go materialize these attacks. So we have to be in the place and time where they exist, and we know that they will happen in these elections as they have in elections past systematically.
Well, when you identify a new approach toward avoiding a fish, is it something electronically that you do, like your Apple sends you an upgrade, or how does it work exactly?
Sure. So our software is in a class called software as a service, meaning that all of our customers actually receive the same product and it's continuously updated, just like the Google web browser, right? You don't have to download or recognize, just updated all across the world. So when we identify new algorithms every single day, those are pushed to our customers. And as I mentioned prior, you know, at a large company of 100,000 people, maybe 5 or 10 people interact with our software, even though it's there. The vast majority of the people are just not receiving the phishing emails. And so we don't expect that federal candidates we work with would have this existential realization that we've come to save the day. They will just probably move on as if nothing happened, and we'll know that we've solved the problem the way that we want to.
But if you have some intrusion and it was a result of a fish that you didn't catch, how do you then amend what your typical formula is, or whatever it is, or algorithm, to deal with something new coming down the pike? Or
well, sir, what I would say is that it's very common, right? We wouldn't be here today if the existing software solutions offered by cloud inbox providers like Google and Microsoft caught the fish that caused the most damage. And as I'm sure you've read the special counsel's report, and as I mentioned, hundreds of these things are passing through. So we work to solve that problem. But secondly, when there are things that are missed or new capabilities, we interact with our customers and they'll say, here's a thing that we think might be suspicious, or here's something that we've learned about that maybe you can take a look at. And our research and development teams are continuously working on that to make improvements around accuracy, timeliness, and the ability to stop the attacks.
So what about the case? So we have in a federal system, and there's candidates have different computers and they have different people coming and going, and one's Podesta and the other is somebody else. And we had some issue regarding whether or not we could assist in financing for certain aspects of activity in the federal government. So does what you do meld with the same kind of anti-phishing device or algorithm that's injected by, say, your government or those that, you know, are dealing with the Russians or the Chinese or that kind of thing?
I'm not sure. I thought, could you?
Well, I get the impression that there's you modify as you go along with new approaches toward
correct continuously
algorithms, as does, I assume, a lot of other entities. I'm thinking of the political parties that might be one day working on one thing and they have a new candidate and wants to work on something else, and mm-hmm. how do you or some that have different levels of sophistication than others.
So how is it that we...
Yeah, how do you work with them? How does that work?
Yeah, so we pay careful attention to the state of the art in computer science, in trends that are happening in the computer security field. And as I mentioned, to build the type of successful company that we're focused on, it takes a multidisciplinary team. And that's why we employ linguists, experts in artificial intelligence, domain experts in cybersecurity, advanced mathematicians. The computational diversity that we bring to bear allows us to make sure that we're able to solve many problems. So think of it maybe this way. When I worked at the National Security Agency, things like high-performance computers, like so-called supercomputers, they can be designed to perform one algorithm like code breaking, so to speak. And that can be akin to a Formula One race car. You know, an F1 car at Monaco, it's like perfect. It does one thing. But if you want to go check the price of corn at 100 stores here in the Washington metro area, the car is the worst car you could ever have. And our approach is like having 1,000 Ford Focuses, right? We have approaches for thousands of different things. And in combination, they allow us to more accurately cover the broadest space possible in phishing. And that's why customers around the world seek our solution. It's been effective in some of the most highly contentious areas.
So is this something that's installed permanently? And
sorry, it's not installed. It's run as what's known as a cloud-based service. Yeah. So it's sort of a ethereal from that perspective.
Thanks.
Mr. Vice Chairman, I think I interrupted you were starting to ask questions, and I got too excited by your questions and interrupted to ask follow-ups. Did you have more questions?
Oh, not a problem. This has been a very helpful discussion. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up, just get a little more. I've heard the discussion regarding the four-factor pricing model, I think I've gotten a little bit of a better feel for what you're doing. But let me ask some questions just to make sure that I fully understand it. The way I understood your explanation, when I gave my earlier hypothetical of comparing the shoestring candidate with a long shot chance of winning versus the longstanding incumbent with a huge war chest, maybe even $1 billion, you were saying that what may seem like a large disparity to us in the political world, in the larger business world that you're operating in, where you're looking at companies that have thousands, tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of employees and are dealing in, you know, billions and billions of dollars, that when you're looking at campaigns, what may look like a disparity between poor candidate and rich candidate isn't that big of a deal in your sphere. And for that reason, you would offer the 1337 to the longstanding incumbent with the big war chest, just the same as you would the shoestring candidate who has a long shot, you know, who's not likely to win. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct. We look at the size of the organization. If you're 10 people,
okay,
that's sort of in our cost for processing your email and the phishing attacks against you. And we don't dictate to our customers based on their financial market caps or war chests how they should apply those dollars. We do it evenly based on kind of like a per unit initial setup.
Okay. And is it also fair to say that when you're applying this pricing model, that not every factor is weighted the same in each application? It seems like from what you've indicated in the remarks you've given today and also in some of your written submissions, that the research and development opportunities presented by being able to provide services to political committees and federal candidates would be especially valuable to your company in terms of developing brand recognition, but also in developing increasingly sophisticated mechanisms for repelling phishing attacks. Is it accurate to say that in the application of these factors, in some instances, one factor may be of greater weight than in other applications?
The research and development is the greatest, value to our business. To the extent the pride factor is related, you need that talented set of people in order to actually conduct the research and development. If we didn't have the best linguists and computer scientists and big data experts and mathematicians, we couldn't attract them, there would be no research and development to do. But the R&D on and of itself is the thing that allows our technology to be successful and have commercial value in the long term. It would be like, Mr. Patel's wrote, like if we were developing a cancer drug, like you would need cancer patients to experiment on.
To cure.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean experiment.
I thought the analogy would be to the cancer, to the researchers and the cancer doctors.
Correct.
Not the patients, right?
I misspoke.
And I guess just the final question. So is it the case that the similarly sized and similarly capitalized organizations that are non-political, that are somewhat on par with what political committees typically present, you provide them the same 1337 pricing model, and that basically candidates are coming to you saying, hey, can we get that same, are we able to avail ourselves of that same pricing model?
Absolutely.
But in other words,
we provide this pricing today to many organizations. It is our standard practice. Candidates have come to us and said, we have heard good things about your product. We're extremely worried about being phished. As we have engaged with them, their legal counsel has said, we're unsure if this pricing is some sort of I don't know what the appropriate word is. And we have said,
corporate in kind.
I was going to say scheme, but and we said, no, this it is not. We have many, many customers who look very much like to you from our perspective, 20, 30 people, are being attacked by nation state governments, have real concerns over it, do not have a full-time staff, are not going to be spending $600 million like JPMorgan Chase or other large Fortune 500 companies. We offer a solution here because it's in our interest to develop the best product, and you can be a partner on that front. So we do that today. We work with many, many people on this front. We propose to offer nothing different for federal candidates. We have no federal candidate cybersecurity program. If candidates so choose to use our product, we want them to have the clarity with your approval that it falls within our standard practice so we can move forward.
And that's helpful to know. And just from what you've described, like I mentioned in what you've said today and what you've said in your written submission, I think that I have a much better understanding of how your company is moving forward and how it's planning to operate. And it seems to me, I don't know if there's other interest on the commission about having further discussions about finding whether or not there might be a way in which we could garner four votes for a yes. If there's not, then I wouldn't trouble the requesters with asking for an extension. But is there a possibility for further discussions on this issue and consideration about approaches for perhaps reaching a consensus on the yes?
Well, from my perspective, this is Ellen. I think you recognize my voice. always a challenge on the phone. I am open to finding a path forward. I think it might require a revised request or a withdrawal and a resubmission of a new request, because I'm not the facts. I still have a couple more questions about the facts, but I'm not sure the facts are as I understood them when I first saw the written submissions, and or as OGC understood them when they drafted the different responses. Because I'm not sure the responses are actually based on the facts as I think I understand them now, although, as I said, I'm going to have a couple more questions on that. Commissioner Hunter?
I was going to suggest something very similar. I think that might be useful. While the request was very helpful and very detailed and followed all of our, you know, our previous case law and that sort of thing, I'm not sure that we even need it. And I think it would be pretty simple. We provide this to everyone, you know, political committees and not, and so therefore it's not a corporate contribution, you know, have a nice day. I don't think we need to get into the pride or any of that other kind of stuff for the business model that you're describing here today. I think it's a lot more simple than we originally thought. So I agree with you on that. And I do think it'd be helpful to have a sort of a fresh request with the more streamlined facts. And I think we would all agreed commit to answering it in a much shorter time frame. We usually require 60 days or allow ourselves 60 days, but in this case, I don't think we would need the 60 days. It might be useful, though, to flesh out your questions.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
We can help Mr. Patalis and you write a request that kind of answers everybody's questions so you don't have to come back again.
No, I was planning on doing that. I just
didn't
want to cut anybody else off. I think you may have overcomplicated your request. So sometimes it's a problem when you know too much. And Mr. Patalis knows a great deal about this area.
That's very kind, Chair. We all know it's not true.
No, it is true. It is true. Mr. Patalis was a highly trusted member of our organization for years. I used to go to you for advice. So I'm looking at the web page, okay? And there are three categories of pricing on the web page. There's pay-per-fish, there's enterprise license agreement, both of which appear to apply for the larger companies that have at least 5,000 employees, and then there's little to no cost, which is, you know, great. I'm sure everybody wants to fall into that category. Now, in your email, you said little to no cost is a subset of the fixed term approach identified on the website as enterprise licensing agreement. But enterprise license agreement, at least according to the website, is a fixed price for 3-year term, 5,000 employees or more. It doesn't actually sound like it's a subset of that. So first question is it or is it not? Does little or no cost, is that category just a separate category, or is it some kind of a subset? And if so, what is this deal with the 5,000 employees?
Well, I we have the CEO here, and he is much more closely, has his hands on the facts in a way, of course, that his advocate does not. That being said, it's my understanding. I don't know why I'm bothering, because he'll just correct it. So the view is, look, there's really one prep strategy, right? You have pay-per-vish, where the variability risk is absorbed by the person who agrees to do it that way. And then you've got, no, you're going to do a fixed price setup. And whether that fixed price is X or little to no cost is going to be determined by, you know, the factors and whether they qualify as an appropriate recipient of that kind of approach. But that's as far as I'll go. Let me hand it over to the man to my right.
I think that was pretty okay.
Do you wish to elaborate, Mr. Malkiewicz?
No, I think that was okay. They're really not separate.
So I thought when I looked at this that you might have a sort of a, if you're a nonprofit organization, you can get the 1337 rate. Is that true, or is it there's a 1337 rate that's available based on the four factors, and we think political committees and a bunch of nonprofits might satisfy the four factors?
Well, many companies would fall into that little or no cost. Startups, as I mentioned, biotech companies, might be 100 people. And so we don't have a nonprofit, you know, pricing. We just say, if you're an organization, that is the category that we can work with you under.
So we're back to the four factors. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry, maybe I missed the question.
I'm really unclear on this. I don't know whether you're saying that there's a category for nonprofits, which could include political committees and startups, smaller organizations, and that by category you fit into this little or no cost, or you look at every single person who comes to you and asks for your services and you evaluate them under the four factors, and if they meet the four factor test, then they win the little or no cost prize.
No, I think the way you said it is correct. Startups, nonprofits, humanitarian organizations, political candidates, they fall into that bucket.
That's a good answer for me. I'm just telling you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they just fall into that bucket.
And could you give me an estimate of what percentage of your clients fall into that little or no cost bucket?
You know, I wouldn't give a percentage, but it's considerable. Not as a percentage, but it's a considerable number of organizations that we work with on that front, and we're very proud to do so. And I can tell you that in every single instance where we have worked with a startup or a nonprofit or some group that falls in the bucket, we have earned immense research and development value. We have issued new patents based on our learnings from that, which are of considerable value. We have developed new and specific product features that are applicable to everyone. It has been very, very valuable to us when we have new features that we want to test and we need specific scenarios. Some folks fall into that bucket, and it's incredibly valuable, and that has supported primarily our business with Global 2000 or Fortune 500 companies, is the ability to work with these organizations. So it's very helpful to us.
So when you say a considerable number, because you're potentially going to be offering this, if we said yes, there are thousands of political committees that
Correct.
Might sign up for your services. So would it then be thousands of political committees and 27 other groups, or hundreds of other groups, or thousands of other groups? I'm trying to figure out whether the political committees would be part of a larger category, or would basically be most of the category?
Well, typically today, we do not market into this space.
I can understand that.
All right. These organizations come to us, and so we offer it. Perhaps this will entice thousands, and so in that thousands of political committees, which would be fantastic, that would certainly be more than the numbers, but we're not seeking through any kind of sales and marketing efforts, nonprofits or startups. We typically are inbound responding to people. And that's the formation of our request today, is that presidential candidates particularly have been coming to us, and we want to make sure they have the clarity to move forward. Thousands would certainly be more than what we have today. Not considerably, though.
Okay. So just to make sure that I'm being clear with you about my thinking about this, if you were to reformulate the request, and if I'm understanding this properly, as, you know, we already offer 1337 pricing to, you know, this category of nonprofits, startups, humanitarian organizations, whoever fits into that bucket, we think that political committees would fit into this same bucket, and we would propose to treat them in the same way that we treat all these other groups that we offer our discounted pricing to. They would just be part of our normal and usual practice with this broader group. That's a framework that I can deal with. If the answer is actually it's not a broader category, it's, you know, every single entity or person who comes in the door, we look at them under these four factors and we decide whether it's going to make our employees proud to come to work every day, that's a heavier lift for me. Okay, so you know what the facts are. I, you know, don't, by all means, I'm not suggesting that you misrepresent anything, but I think I understand that there is a path forward in identifying the political committees as part of a larger category of entities to whom you offer, who are similarly situated, that you offer the same pricing to, and that would fit squarely into our precedents. And I think in this regard that perhaps Commissioner Hunter and I are on the same page on this, that, you know, a simpler request along those lines would be easier for us to answer. Commissioner Hunter.
You are correct. I think we're saying the same exact thing, which doesn't happen all that often. But in, what's the last category you keep talking about on the right-hand side? Little to nothing?
Little to no cost.
The only thing I wanted to add in...
Which apparently means 1337.
Yeah, so let me know if this doesn't make sense to you. So I think to make it even more simple than what the chair just said, I think you're saying there's no way that you would charge a political committee more than the 1337, because your high watermark that you mentioned earlier was Hillary Clinton's campaign was 4,000 employees, and that's even lower than your small people anyway, right? So I'm not, again, we don't want to put words in your mouth or facts in your stuff, but it seems
conceptually
like,
conceptually that is correct. It would be below our typical.
Right. So it seems as though every political campaign, even the large ones, fit into that bucket, which makes it even more simple, right?
I guess.
Then you don't have to go through any factors to decide if they go from little to no cost to whatever the other ones.
Although I could imagine a presidential campaign with, you know, if they had a whole lot of volunteers throughout the country that were had
they
that
don't
had,
usually give volunteers their email
address. Right. Well, that's, you know, but
they don't.
I'm just saying it's not impossible for me to envision that a national campaign could cross the 5,000 mark. But so I don't know how much you want to wed yourself to that. But certainly it would only be a national, you know, we might be talking about two campaigns at most. Commissioner Walther.
Thanks. And a little to no cost, when you say four qualified organizations, what do you mean by qualified at this point?
Qualified to the four factors that we've been talking about.
It's the four factors.
That's
what I wanted.
Well, they're the criteria. They're of a certain size, right? That they fall into that bucket.
I see. So what prevents you from raising that limit after a period of time? It's 1337, everybody gets signed up, or everybody's happy, and then 24 months and things have changed and we need to charge you more now. So how is there any stability in terms of that? Do people sign up for certain periods of time at a fixed rate, or how does that work?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, typically when we contract with organizations, it's for fixed periods of time, and then it's renegotiated or reevaluated at the end of that term. So we would withhold the right to change pricing, right, continuously.
How new is your company?
5 years.
5 years. So how long is the average contract?
Well, no more than 5 years today.
Oh, I understand that. How many are less than that?
Typically, customers engage with us contractually for 1 or 3 year time periods, and then they will renew the terms of the contracts in those intervals.
I see.
Commissioner Hunter.
Going back to Commissioner Walther's question about who's qualified, isn't it something along the lines of what you said earlier, which is 5,000 or less, 5,000 employees or less are qualified for the, what's it called again, little to no, to the, for the 1337?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, but is it, no, I just, you know, we got to get the facts right, and it's the facts are a little bit complicated. So is it anybody who has less than 5,000, fewer than 5,000 employees, or fewer than 5,000 employees and factors 2, 3, and 4? The four-factor test is somewhat problematic for me, in part because of the precedent that it would be setting for other organizations who would come in and say, well, we also, you know, would be highly motivated if, you know, we could do this, if we could do this work for political committees for free. And like I said, Congress could change the law, but they haven't. So we're stuck with the law that we've got, which was written in a time before there were cyber attacks, because it was before there was cyber.
Yes, I think the way that you phrase it is correct. And I apologize for creating any confusion. I'm just trying to create clarity. As I said, startups mostly suck at pricing.
So,
Mr. Patelis.
Thank you, Chair. So, right, the question is who qualifies, right?
Right.
And that's so there's no question that in setting prices, right, they take a number of things into consideration. But the primary or the priorities are, you know, how big is this organization, not in like dollars, but in size that matters to Area 1's interests. And then the R&D element is considerable because the product they offer is really just a manifestation of research and development, right? It's a cloud-based software. So that's what's driving the decision. You got a smaller organization relative to what is large in this context, and high value to the development of the very product that they sell. Okay. It's nice to have the pride factor too. It's nice, right? The commission knows firsthand about the value to morale and the quality of the employees you can get when you offer interesting work to highly credentialed people who could make more elsewhere, right?
Yes.
But so that's, there's, and Area 1 takes advantage of that as well, of course. But that's not really, that's not the driver here, right? So I think in any request and in assessing who fits into this bucket, if the issue for the commission is the squishy pride issue, then that doesn't have to be taken into account. I'm not the board of directors or the CEO, but it strikes me that I don't know to what extent that's really required, it sounds like to me, to fit into that bucket. So that's, I think, the question.
Not confusing those two. Yes, that's correct.
Well, I...
Good going, Dan.
I think that Mr. Patelis understands my concerns. And I think I understand the facts. So, which I don't think are fairly represented in the drafts that we have in front of us. So I don't want to, I suspect nobody really does, but I know I don't want to vote on either of the drafts that we have in front of us because I'm not sure that they accurately reflect the actual facts, the business plan of the organization. So if, having been informed by this conversation, you want to withdraw your request and submit a reformulated request that you think, based on our conversation, might be easier for us to answer, I would encourage you to do so. I think what you are proposing to do would be valuable and important, and if there's a way to say yes without doing damage to the law, I would be inclined to try to do so. So I will, that obviously, you guys know the facts better. You guys, Mr. Patelis is well-versed in the law, and I think you hear what I'm saying. So I'll leave it up to you whether you think that would be a productive exercise. I don't know if any of my colleagues want to weigh in on that. Commissioner Walther.
Thank you. I'm not quite as far along in terms of wrapping up the conversation because I had a couple more questions.
Sure, sure.
And one was, you say also down there on the little to no cost, full implementation with minimal IT involvement. If you have not minimal IT involvement, then you automatically go to some other category, or how do you price it? How do you price at that point?
Small companies typically have a concern that enterprise software is complex to deploy, but it takes less than 10 minutes to deploy our software from the largest company to the small. So it's just an indication for groups that might be exploring our services that this is a very simple thing for them to do. That's not a criteria that a Fortune 500 company even concerns themselves with because they know they have hundreds of people working for it. And so we want them to know that this is a straightforward, simple process to set up our software. It takes 10 minutes.
So
I'd be happy to show you.
It doesn't affect the cost. It's not a cost.
No, it's the same for everyone.
The other question I had is, I don't know what factors we're going to be left with by the time you revise your document.
I'm getting the sense that factors are not
but
appreciated.
But in terms of research and development, how much research and development do you really gain once you learn how a political campaign works?
I mean, well, sir, we get no value from understanding how a political campaign works. What we get value from is the specific cyber attacks that happen at the organizations and customers that we work with. Political campaigns are uniquely situated to be attacked by nation states. Commercial entities are sometimes uniquely situated to be attacked by criminal or people looking for financial gain. And so the value is in the attacks, not in the organizations. We seek to know nothing about how the campaigns work.
Interesting. Thanks.
Any further questions, comments? Commissioner Peterson, you got anything else for us?
No, I think just in listening to the discussion and listening to my colleagues, it sounds like there may be a way forward, and I hope that we can hope we can get the opportunity to figure out if we can reach that consensus, because I do think there's a potential path forward in light of I think the value that that this company offers to provide. I think it would be worthwhile if we could find that path.
I agree with that sentiment. Commissioner Walther?
This will be my last question. So we go with this, and we have your phishing software. And along comes X company and says, we have better phishing software. And that sounds attractive. Different fish or different ways or whatever. Can you have them running together, or would you have to take yours out or never take theirs, or how does it work? If you have, because there's chances are that people might come and say, well, we really think this is a great job, but we're more sophisticated in this area or whatever.
Nothing is more sophisticated and better than what I offer. But in light of any skepticism about that matter, not knowing the specifics, right. Yes, it is possible to use our software with other complementary services. That's part of the reason why we have the pricing model called Paper Fish, which is to say, if you think you've got something, we'll only charge you for the things that we catch. It turns out we catch a lot of things because we're so great at what we do. But today, just as an aside, you know, companies are spending billions of dollars on cybersecurity solutions, and the results aren't really getting any better for them. And so we've taken this approach around accountability, which is to say, our value is in stopping attacks, and you should pay for that on a per unit basis. And so if you've invested in things today, you should pay for the specific value that we provide, and that that is sort of the genesis of how we've gotten there. Does that help?
It does, and then just as a matter of when you bump up against a fish and you prevent it.
I would swim the other way.
You would swim the other way. That's the theory. But how do you calculate differently than one that does invade and then you kill it? Is there a difference in how the software works? As I understand it, if a fish may be successful in intruding, and there, or another fish might never get in. I'm talking in real layperson's terms, but I just wonder how that works.
Any attempt to make a user click on a link, download a file, transfer money or sensitive documents unwittingly as a result of a fish is what we aim to stop.
For me?
Well, seeing and hearing no other questions, this has been very interesting and illuminating. We thank you for coming in. It really was very helpful to have you here, Mr. Falkowitz.
Thank you very much.
I'm pretty sure that Mr. Patalis is right that you understand your product better than he does. but he does know the law. So I think between the two of you, perhaps you can craft a better a request that might be more likely to achieve success here. And I, like the vice chairman, I hope we can, and I think all my colleagues, I think we are hopeful that we can find a path forward that allows you to provide a valuable service on the same terms as you are providing it to other folks and does not do damage to the law. So I don't have anything else to say about this. And anybody at the staff want to ask any questions? No? Okay, then. Well, then I thank you both. And we will look forward to hearing further from you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Deputy Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters we need to discuss?
There are no such matters.
In that case, this meeting is adjourned.